This evening we're going to be talking about difficult questions and situations. Over the years, I've given people opportunity for questions on the subject of divorce and remarriage, and you can imagine we've gotten plenty of those over the years. And so we're going to discuss some of those tonight. And if you're listening to this as a recording and haven't listened to sessions that speak about what marriage is like, Genesis 1 and 2, Jesus' comments regarding marriage, the Apostle Paul's comments regarding marriage, the earlier sessions that we've gone through, you should go do them first, because what we're doing tonight assumes you've already covered that part. In other words, you have to have the biblical material first. You can't just say, oh, I wonder what he has to say about this question and that question and somebody else's question. In fact, I'm afraid that's what people love to do. Let's skip the Bible and listen to the opinions of man. I'm going to try to have what I have to say, of course, be based on the Bible, but the Bible does not specifically address some of the questions that people raise. You have to come to the answer by being informed by the Bible. So the discussion tonight assumes you've got that under your belt. If you haven't, please get it under your belt. Here are some answers to objections that are made when people hear that we believe that remarriage after divorce is adultery and that you cannot continue to stay in an adulterous union. Well, there are reasons that we should accept the divorced and remarried as they are. And here's one of the arguments. Jesus and the apostles did not address correction of existing but inappropriate marriages. Neither should we. That's one of the arguments that people use. First of all, that kind of argument is an argument from silence. And it's very dangerous to base such an important conclusion on such a thing, because you do not know what all Jesus and the Apostle Paul or the other apostles said about various subjects. We only have a very small portion of what they said and wrote. However, precisely that issue is addressed in the New Testament. John the Baptist was filled with the Holy Spirit from his mother's womb. There was not a greater born of women than John. He was the forerunner of Christ. He prepared the way for Christ. And John made a gigantic issue of the sin of Herod continuing to live with Herodias, whom he had married. And by the way, Herod was a rank unbeliever. And so God holds unbelievers accountable for wicked marriages that they have contracted. And John made an issue of it, and it cost him his life. Now, the insistence on dissolving inappropriate marriages that John made when he said regarding Herod, "It is not lawful for you to have her." He didn't say it is not lawful that you took her, but it is not lawful for you to have her. That insistence and the results of it would have been emphatically written on the minds of the apostles and on those who heard and read the gospel accounts. And it should be emphatically written on our minds also. You could argue, of course, that John was writing in the Old Testament era, since Jesus had not died yet, had not resurrected yet. And so even in that era, John, speaking under the power of the Holy Spirit, insisted, "Herod, you have no right to that woman. It is not right for you to live with her." Another objection that people make is God accepts people. It's true that God does accept people. God accepts all sinners at conversion. This does not mean that they can freely continue in any or all sins of their previous life. A man must forsake everything and even his own life to be a disciple of Christ. Some people say this: if a divorced person marries another person, then that act of adultery completely ends the previous marriage. The answer to that is that this statement is merely an assertion without proof. You know, again and again, we have listened Two people make statements that are nothing but claims that they never prove, as if it's a valid claim. What if somebody told you that the sky is green? And you say, oh, well, maybe we should consider it. You see, this argument actually overturns the natural reading of the text. No one would ever conclude this except to excuse a relationship with a divorced person. Another argument is the second marriage involves a covenant that should not be broken. There are people in this world that work as hired killers. They're called hitmen. Let's suppose you were a hitman and you've received $5,000 as a contract from your mafia boss to knock off that guy over there, and you'll get the next $5,000 when you get him knocked off. So you've already received the $5,000, you're on the way to do the job, and you meet a street preacher and get converted. And so you tell your pastor, sir, I'll see you next weekend because I have a job that I have committed myself to doing, namely killing this certain person. Of course not. You cannot uphold a wicked contract. You see, we do not multiply evil by fulfilling an evil promise. Remember the example of Ezra. He said, there is hope for Israel if we make a covenant with God to break these marriages that they had no right to. You see how the logic is? If I steal, I can wonderfully provide for my family. If I do something that is wrong, I can be a blessing. Same kind of logic. Or what about maybe there's a homosexual couple, even with children? That involves a covenant that must be broken. Some people say, well, we don't want to break up these homes, and we don't want to do it but because for the sake of the children. Jesus said there are some who are eunuchs for the kingdom of heaven's sake. And he certainly was not always thinking of childless couples. The severe action precedent by Ezra that we spoke about the other night involved couples that had children. In fact, staying together as an adulterous couple is one of the most damaging things you can do for your child. You need to separate for their sake. Only then will they learn that what you've done is truly wrong. If you stay together and do well as a couple, they will learn, oh, you can get married, and if you mess up, you can get a divorce, and then you can marry someone else, and God will bless you in it. That's precisely the message that the devil wants them to know, wants them to believe. A preacher asked an audience one time, he said, which is worse, committing adultery or causing children to be fatherless? That was a wicked proposal of the question. It's not a question of which is worse. It's a question of how to obey God. You see, such questions undermine the standard that God has for marriage. And furthermore, it's a false question too, because separation from an adulterous union does not make a child fatherless. The father needs to work out an arrangement for caring for the child without living wickedly with his mother. This has been done and is being done, and can be done. Someone says, I want to remarry because my children need a dad. The fundamental issue at hand is not solving some problem, but is obedience to Christ instead. You see, remarriage doesn't even necessarily solve problems for the child anyway. It often increases his problems. On the average, children from step families do no better than those of single-parent families. That information comes from a sociological study. In fact, remarriage is a breeding ground for conflicts between the child and the new parent. Someone makes this objection. Well, then evangelism is impossible. I mean, everywhere we go in our society, we have divorce and remarriage. The gospel becomes bad news. People will be afraid to join the church. That is a gross misunderstanding of the gospel. It is always good news to turn away from sin and embrace God's grace in Christ. And it is always bad news not to. Besides, it is God who adds the truly repentant to his church. Remember, in the book of Acts, chapter 5, verse 13, some people were afraid to join the church. The gospel is bad news for those who refuse it. In 2 Corinthians, it says, we are the aroma to some of death unto death, and others life unto life. In fact, this bad news argument would imply that the gospel is bad news for the murderer or thief or homosexual who didn't want to change. The gospel is bad news, if you want to call it that, for the person who's refusing to stay in his wicked behavior. Because the gospel not only says Jesus is the way of salvation, but the gospel also says judgment is coming. Somebody will say, well, I know somebody that's divorced and remarried, and they have a powerful Christian testimony and a great Christian ministry. I have a book in my library at home called The Adventures of a Deserter. It is an exposition on the life of Jonah. Jonah deserted God's plan, went down to that ship. The weather must have been fine. The guy was, the pilot of the ship was congenial. Jonah had the money. He paid the fare. The sailing is great. But you know something? God is a better chess player than Jonah. All of a sudden, there's a storm. And because Jonah was on that ship, the sailors received a dramatic testimony that they probably wouldn't have received otherwise. That doesn't mean Jonah should have been there. And one of the things this book said that I've never forgotten, God can strike straight blows with crooked sticks. Just because a crooked stick says something that's true doesn't mean the crooked stick is right in what the crooked stick is doing. God spoke prophetically through Balaam, even though Balaam was actively working against God. You see, this is not the way to decide theology. The questions of the Christian woman's covering, the question of non-resistance, you don't decide whether those are right or wrong by looking at some preacher. Well, he's very successful. He preaches good sermons. I hear lots of spiritual insight. And if he's not preaching the truth in some area, that doesn't prove that the truth in that area is false. You see, when a man preaches correctly from a given text, God blesses his word, even though there may be moral failure in other areas. The evil high priest of Jesus' day spoke truly regarding the expediency of Christ dying for the nation, even though he meant it very differently than what truly spiritual people understand. In fact, regardless of whether an illegitimate marriage is pleasant or rocky, it produces a bad result. Because if it gets along well, it produces the bad result of encouraging marital infidelity. And if it gets along bad, it exhibits bad principles of marriage. Somebody's going to say, but the new relationship is such a blessing. You remember the story of Paltiel and Michael, who he had no right to? Paltiel dearly loved Michael, and he followed for a long time when judgment fell and she was taken away from him and that wicked marriage was split apart. And he had such a nice time with her for all those years. The new relationship is such a blessing, people think. Lamech, in Genesis chapter 4, arrogantly went against God's plan and married two women, Ada and Zillah. And you know what God did? God, in his generosity, gave him geniuses for children. Amazing. Oh, so the new relationship has produced such a blessing. It's beside the point. the formation of that relationship and the continuation of that relationship is against God's will. There are various objections that people make, miscellaneous ones. Some claim concerning the exception, for something to be true, God only needs to say it once. For an exception, for example, the exception. You know, that's true, but it misses the point. We're not denying that Jesus gave the exception. The question we're dealing with is, what does the exception include? And I think a fair study of all the scriptures in the New Testament means that the exception includes an exception for divorce, but not for remarriage. You see, you can't take an exception in one phrase or in one sentence and automatically say that applies to all other statements regarding marriage and divorce. Some people claim that the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus was only clarifying the true intent of the Old Testament. He came not to destroy, but to fulfill, they say. In other words, he's not changing the law. The answer is, read Sermon on the Mount yourself. Jesus clearly did change some things. He referred to the fact that in the Old Testament, there was a saying that said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And Jesus said, but I say to you, do good to the one who strikes you. And in particular, he changed things about divorce. In the Old Testament, marrying a divorcee was not counted as adultery. In the New Testament, Jesus said, whoever marries a divorced person commits adultery. If that isn't a change, I think somebody needs to understand something about language. Doesn't matter whether you read it in English or in Greek. That's different from what the Old Testament says. Somebody else makes an objection. The translators were faulty in translation. They should have said put away instead of divorce. And so Jesus is saying, whoever puts away his wife and marries another commits adultery because she hadn't been divorced. In other words, he's still married to her. Somebody gave me a paper that was making that claim. You know what you need to do? Look at the verse and see what it says. Matthew 5:31, Jesus refers to the old way of putting away, and the word is apoluo, a wife, and then giving her a bill of divorcement. So that's clearly talking about divorce. Then in verse 32, he uses the same root word to speak of a man putting away his wife, apuluon, and of adultery with the woman who has been put away, apulelulumenon. You see, it's the same root word in all those cases. And so their argument is false. It's an example of a person twisting the scriptures to their own destruction and to the destruction of those who listen to them. Somebody wonders, is porneia the only exception? Sometimes divorce is necessary for other reasons, like maybe danger to the life of the wife or children or incest. Remember, the Pharisees specifically asked, is divorce permitted for any cause? And Jesus answers and gives the only cause that he mentions, porneia, as an exception, making clear that no other's allowed. Now, the other things that people talk about, like physical danger to the wife, threats to her life, criminal activities, those are criminal acts that are to be handled by the governmental justice, Romans 13, verse 1 to 4. The civil authorities are to restrain evil. They do not bear the sword in vain. In other words, evildoers are to be punished. These criminal acts are not eliminated or punished by divorce. You don't say, well, if a man is a murderer, let him get a divorce from his wife. I think that'll fix the murderer problem. Or if a man is a thief, let him get a divorce. I think that'll fix the theft problem. You see, divorce legally releases from obligation and opens the door for remarriage to someone else and then repeat the criminal offenses. Somebody says this, God is the God of new beginnings, the God who brings healing. In fact, this was an idea that was pushed by Catherine Marshall. You remember years ago, there was a man named Peter Marshall, and there was a book written about him. He was influential as a chaplain in the American government, I think it was. And he said some good spiritual things. His wife can say some good spiritual things too. She at least did at one time. But this was an idea pushed by Catherine Marshall's second husband after Peter died, her second husband, Lynn. The book was called Light in My Darkest Night. And Lynn married Catherine. But it was Lynn's second marriage. And Catherine agonized over whether to marry Lynn because she knew what the scripture taught. She finally decided to marry him, and then she agonized over what she had done. And the book is full of confusion. It says some things that are right mixed with some things that are spiritually a mess. Now, Catherine Marshall's new husband, Lynn, after Catherine died, he still didn't go back to his original wife and give her a new beginning. You see, doesn't God care about the forsaken wife? People love to say, well, God is a God of new beginnings. Begin by what? Forsaking this wife and going and marrying somebody else? Well, where's her new beginning, pray tell? You see, marrying somebody else does not produce healing. It deepens the fracture. That book exhibited spiritual confusion and turmoil. Well, why can't the innocent party remarry? You see, the real issue is whether the marriage is dissolved. If the marriage is dissolved, then both the innocent and guilty parties may remarry, because if the marriage is dissolved, there's not a problem. If it's not dissolved, neither can remarry. You can't say, well, one partner can remarry and the other partner can't. Because the reason that prohibits remarriage is you've got a spouse that's still alive. You see, porneia does not dissolve a marriage. We talked about that a little bit earlier. Some people claim it does, but that's certainly not the case. And divorce doesn't dissolve the marriage either, because it says whoever marries a divorced person commits adultery. If that's true, then what it implies, and we know it is true because God says so, if whoever marries a divorced person commits adultery, that means a single person marrying a divorced person is committing adultery, which means that the person he married is still connected to the original husband. Otherwise, it wouldn't be adultery because he's a single person. And so that shows there's a continuing marital relationship even though a legal divorce has occurred. Some people say this: your position is unfair. The honorable person who marries and then experiences disaster cannot remarry. But the promiscuous person who didn't marry anybody at all but had 20 partners, he can marry. And the answer is, marriage is permissible not because people have been promiscuous, but because they are not married. Now, it wouldn't be wise to marry a person that's been catting around with 20 other persons. That wouldn't be wise at all. But you see, it's not that marriage to such a person is prohibited by the rules of God regarding marriage. You see, the criterion for whether a person is eligible for marriage is what? You can't already be married. Somebody might say, well, don't you believe in having mercy? And the answer is, yes. But what is truly mercy? Is it teaching people that they can ignore what God says? Or is it teaching them to obey God now and be prepared for eternity? Failure to teach people to obey God now and be ready for eternity is not love at all. Someone may say this: Christ himself told us not to separate what God has joined. You are disobeying Christ if you demand separation. God himself does not join illegitimate marriages. Remember, when the Pharisees asked about, can you divorce your wife? Then Jesus said, haven't you read that the one who created them made them male and female? What God has joined together, let not man put asunder. Now just imagine this. If God would join illegitimate marriages, and at the same time, he says, a man who divorces his wife and marries someone else, and so God joins that marriage, is committing adultery, and you can't separate what God has joined, then the person is stuck in adultery because he can't separate what God has joined, and is condemned because he's an adulterer. That is self-contradictory. So it is impossible that God joins illegitimate unions. So we are not separating what God has joined. We are saying you cannot continue to live in legalized adultery. Someone will say, but this standard you raise is entirely too hard. And that attitude shows failure in appropriating the teaching of Jesus and Paul. You see, God joins man and woman in marriage, and that's dissolved only by death. That's a marvelous privilege. And singleness gives a supreme opportunity to serve God in special ways not available to the married. That's what Paul says. And so that means there's marvelous fellowship and reward by singlehood. And so we can understand the teaching. It's marvelous to be married, and it's marvelous to be single. That has to be true to understand what Jesus and Paul both said. And so if you are called to be a eunuch for the kingdom of heaven's sake because you got into a marriage tangle and you divorced your wife or she divorced you and you have to live singly, that's not the curse of death. That is actually an opportunity to gain special rewards from God as you serve Him faithfully in ways not even possible for a married person. We should make a comment here about when you are having discussions with people on this topic, be sure you give your answers correctly. Don't make false claims. For example, some people will say this, the present tense, he who divorces his wife and marries, present tense, commits adultery, present tense, I'm sorry, I didn't say it quite right. He who divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery, present tense. That shows it's continuing adultery. That is not a correct statement. The present tense commits adultery shows that it accommodates the idea of continual action but does not demand it. Let me give you an example in English. And by the way, it's true in Greek too. If you say, he eats pickles, that doesn't mean he continually eats pickles. You're just saying he eats pickles. That's something that he does. So you see, when you say, if a man divorces his wife and marries another, he commits adultery, the word commits adultery doesn't in itself say it's continual. It just says he does it. So what I'm saying is, don't make an argument like that, because the argument is false, even though your conclusion may be correct. When you make a false argument to support a correct conclusion, it undermines your conclusion. Because a thinking person who listens says, ha, he doesn't know what he's talking about. You see, a better argument is like this. Adultery is a state as well as an act. Marriage is both an act and a state, an act of getting married, and then a state of marriage. And thus, any remarriage is both an act and a state, and thus, any adulterous marriage is both an act and a state. That's a much better argument. Some people say, well, the object lesson by Paul in Romans 7, verses 1 to 5, this proves that remarriage after divorce is adultery. That statement as proof is not valid. because in Romans 7, 1-5, according to the law, a woman could not divorce her husband. She was under the law of her husband as long as he is alive, and for her to be joined to another man was adultery unless her husband had died. And the main point is, the death of the husband makes it possible for her to be in a legitimate new relationship. Otherwise, she's an adulteress. You see, this example is not discussing a divorced woman. It's discussing a married woman who has a husband and then forms a relationship with another man while her husband is still alive. So it's not addressing quite the question we're talking about. And sometimes people glibly point at that and use it as an argument. You see, if we are faithful to what the teaching of the New Testament is on this subject, that means that we're going to have to avoid tolerating cancer in the church. And you know, when people embrace this cancer as individual couples, as an individual couple in the church, it includes a moral cancer that goes into their lives and the lives of the people around them, because it affects the way you make decisions in other areas as well. Somebody might wonder this: does illegitimate marriage forever preclude appropriate marriage? Now, that's a question that I invariably get asked in one form or another. And I want to appeal to you as we go to answer this question that we come to the scriptures for conclusions on this matter. It's easy to have opinions. People love to have opinions. But you know, many people would rather hold on to their opinions than to face the scriptures and have to jettison the opinions they have. So I'm inviting you to test it by the scriptures. Test your opinions by the scriptures and mine by the scriptures. The fundamental question is this: when a couple appears on your doorstep, let's say on the doorstep of your church, the fundamental question is, are they in adultery or are they not? That's the fundamental question. Are they in a valid marriage or are they not? Now, the implications of those questions is, if a marriage is invalid, if the marriage is illegitimate, then it's sin for them to stay together. But if the marriage is valid, it is sinful to refuse them full fellowship. It is impossible to take a certain course just to be safe. That is a wrong and wicked procedure when you're talking about a couple that's standing before you that got married. You've got to know the answer, either yes or no. Either it's right for them to stay together, and if it is right for them to stay together, it is sin for you to even suggest that they separate. And if it's not right for them to stay together, it's sin for them to stay together, and it's sin for you to suggest that staying together is fine. It has to be either yes or no. It is not a maybe. Or why don't you separate just to be safe? Separating just to be safe is the wrong answer. And that is what many people have said over the years. So if a person comes to your church and they're already married, the real question is, are they living in adultery? It's either yes or no. You cannot be partly living in adultery. You can't say, well, my arm is in adultery, but the rest of me isn't. It's either you are living in adultery or you're not. You see, illegitimate marriage is officially sanctioned adultery. It is not genuine marriage. Now, marriage is a union that is God-joined. Unless the union is God-joined, it is not marriage. That's clearly the emphasis of Matthew 19, verse 4-9. God, if you want to turn to that, you can glance at it as I go over this. Matthew 19, 4. God instituted a marriage with one man and one woman. A man leaves father and mother. He's not leaving some previous spouse. God joins those two who can legitimately be married, verse 6. And this joining must not be tampered with. The entire passage has to be understood from that background. It's the question, can you divorce a God-joined legitimate marriage? If you remarry after such a divorce, you are living in adultery. Now, Jesus says that illegitimate marriage is adultery. And hence, illegitimate marriage cannot be, John, cannot be God joined. Otherwise, God would be joining people into what he forbids. You see, it's impossible to be truly joined by God in marriage and to be committing adultery with that woman at the same time. You can't have that. That is not possible. And so if it were God joined, then God would be demanding a hopeless contradiction, impossible to obey. Cease from adultery, separate from her. But what God has joined, if that were the case, let not man put asunder. Now notice the contrast between marriage and harlotry. God joins people in marriage, Matthew 19, verse 6, but a man joins himself to a harlot, 1 Corinthians 6, 15 or 16. An adulterous marriage is not God joined. Hence, it is only man joined as to a harlot. Somebody may say, well, when children are produced by such unions, hasn't God joined them? Well, the answer is, of course, God creates the child, and that's an inseparable joining of both partners in that sense. But that is not joining them in marriage. Children are also produced by harlots, but God does not join them in marriage to their lovers. You see, illegitimate marriage is a wicked covenant to persist in adultery, and this covenant cannot righteously be fulfilled. A man honors God when he refuses to fulfill a wicked covenant. God does not hold a person binding to a covenant which is impossible to fulfill righteously. Otherwise, the man is forced to do additional evil instead of repenting immediately. A man cannot be righteous in refusing to fulfill a covenant and at the same time be bound by God to that covenant. You can't have that contradictory thing going on at the same time. It reminds me of the foolish dilemma that sometimes people like to say because they think it's cute. Well, if God is all-powerful, can he make a rock so big he can't lift it? You see, that's a self-contradictory thing. And God doesn't do self-contradictory things. Marriage terminology for illegitimate union does not mean those unions are God-joined. You know, sometimes people say, well, in relation to Herod, the divine commentary in the Bible, it says Herod married her. So that means they were married. The Bible is just using common, ordinary language, just like we do. We say some man divorced his wife and married another woman. That does not imply that we believe at all that that is a God-joined marriage. He just went through the legal procedure. You see, this whole thing of using terminology rigidly produces so many heresies. I mean, for example, King Saul worshipped the Lord in 1 Samuel 15:31, but it obviously wasn't deeply sincere worship. And in the New Testament, the same word in these different verses is used for worship. The soldiers worshipped Christ, Mark 15:19. Obviously, it was mockery. But it still uses the same word. So it's not true worship. The desire of the wise men in Matthew 2:2 to worship, and of Herod, Matthew 2:8, uses the same word. They clearly had a different kind of worship in mind. You see, we must not take words of Scripture and wooden-headedly impose a certain meaning in all cases when the context makes it clear what he's talking about. After stilling the sea, after Christ stilled the sea, rather, the disciples worshipped Christ, Matthew 14:33. One of the most prevalent foundations of heresy is a rigid insistence that the meaning of a word in one biblical text must mean exactly the same thing in all texts. You know the story of Paltiel that we looked at the other evening? He was married to Michael in a formal sense, but in 1 Samuel 25:44, she is still called David's wife. And years later, David still calls her his wife, 2 Samuel 3:14. And Paltiel is repeatedly referred to as her husband. Well, who does she belong to? Obviously, she belonged to David, Paltiel had a false and invalid marriage, and Michael had an invalid marriage and had an invalid husband who followed along until finally Abner said, "Go back." And he went back to an empty house. Another argument people have is, even if a man is divorced from an illegitimate relationship, he's divorced, and Jesus said whoever marries a divorced person commits adultery. And they think that means that if a person ever was divorced from a relationship, that he never could marry at all. And we're going to look at a chart in a little bit that'll talk about that. But remember, marriage to a divorced woman is adultery not because she's divorced, but because she belongs to another man. She's still married to another man. And the proof of that fact is if her first husband dies, she's free to remarry even though she is a divorced woman. So you see, it's not whether a person's been divorced that you can't marry him. It's because the divorced person is still connected to their original spouse. But if that other person dies, that person is available for marriage. So the key is you cannot remarry because the divorcee is still married in spite of the legal action that occurred. So, the conclusion we have here is that an invalid contract has no hold on a person. A person who was only involved in an illegitimate marriage is not bound in marriage by that false marriage after he separates. A person under such circumstances and who has already remarried should be received in full fellowship, and it's sinful to make them feel like they should separate. Now, marriage tangles must be approached on two levels. The first one is to determine if the current marriage is adulterous. And the second one, which I'm going to get to later, is to determine whether the proposed marriage is sin. There's a difference. How do we get the answer? The answer is always determined by an existence of a God-joined marriage, and the answer may involve multiple and complex histories, but dates and events can be checked at the courthouse. There's no maybe, not surprising, it's crystal clear. And by the way, the question came up one night about, does the state have the right to say you need to register in the courthouse for your marriages and all that, to have it recognized by the state? And I say it's a good thing. And when we go through this exercise, you'll see why. It's because you need to sometimes check and see who was married to who, on what date, and when it was, and who they were the sons or daughters of. And then you need to check on somebody else because they're connected to somebody else. And if it was just somebody was married in a church, and then that church dissolved because they had a big explosion of some kind later on, 3 years later, and the pastor is dead, and where are the records? Nobody knows. And 10 years go by, and nobody knows any record anywhere that that couple was ever married. It's an important issue. Why don't we turn on the screen, and we'll look at this a little bit. All right, suppose that a couple shows up at the door of your church and wants to fellowship with the group here, Abe and Ann. And of course, as people that are concerned about people in the community, you want to welcome them as believers into fellowship with you. But as you talk with them, you find out that Abe had a former wife. Now, is that a problem or is it not a problem? He's married to Ann now. It was in a legal marriage, but Abe had a former wife. The answer is it is not necessarily a problem because maybe Abe's former wife died. If his former wife had died, you know what the scripture teaches. Abe is free to marry Ann. But let's suppose that as you're having discussions, and you know, people talk about their former life, and as you talk about, you know, where they've been, what they've done, you find that Abe did have a former wife that is still alive. Her name was Beth. Oh dear. Now, is the marriage between Abe and Anne valid? You don't know yet. You see, Abe and Bev got a divorce, and then Abe and Anne got married. So you check to find out what the deal was with Bev. Well, it turns out that she had been formerly married to Ben before she got married to Abe. Oh. Well, was the marriage with Bev and Ben, was that a valid marriage? You don't know. I mean, maybe. Maybe it was just neither of them had been married before. You don't know. So you check some more, and you find out that Ben had been married to Carla. Oh, was that a valid marriage? The answer is, you don't know. Well, you check some more in more courthouse records, and you find that Carla had been married to Chris. Well, was that a valid marriage? You check the records, and you find out that neither of them had ever been married. Chris, this is his first marriage. Carla, this is her first marriage. They both left father and mother, and so, what do you say? That was a valid marriage. But then they got a divorce, and Carla married Ben. But Chris is still alive. So is the marriage between Carla and Ben valid? No, it's not. But then they got a divorce. And then Ben married Beth. Has Ben ever had a valid marriage? No, he hasn't. Since he never had a valid marriage, he does not have a valid spouse that's alive. And so, Bev, who never had a valid marriage, this relationship between Ben and Bev is a valid marriage. Then Bev and Ben get a divorce. And so, Bev marries Abe. But Ben, and here's where you need court records, Ben is still alive. You have to find out, is this guy still alive? Oh, yes. So Bev marries Abe, but it's not a valid marriage because she has another husband. Well, then Bev and Abe get a divorce. But Abe had only been married to Bev, and that was not a valid marriage. So he has no spouse that's alive that is valid, and therefore his marriage to Anne is valid. Now, do you see what that means? You have to do your homework. And that's why court records, where the government keeps it for 100 years or more, is very important. And the more wretched our society becomes, the more important that's going to be able to do to check out the details. Okay, you can just turn that off if you like. You see, the key here is anyone who does not have a God-joined partner still alive could marry without being guilty of adultery. And that fits a question that is often asked in traditional marriages, are you free from other marriage relationships? Any couple who arrives at your fellowship who is presently living in a God-joined marriage can be received into fellowship. Now, see, the first question to ask, is this relationship adultery? And we went through this scenario because you can find out and know for sure whether the relationship is adultery or not. But there's another question you have to ask. Is the proposed marriage sin? You see, if somebody already appears and they've already married and it's God joined, you mustn't mess with it. But let's suppose somebody comes and says, oh, I was in an invalid marriage before. Now, could I marry someone who's never been married? There are four criteria you must ask. One is this an adulterous marriage? And you check that out. If it's an adulterous marriage, it is out of consideration. The second one, is this a righteous marriage? If one of the persons is an unbeliever and the other is a believer, it is not righteous. It's out of the question. Or does it bring a snare? Third question, is it wise? In other words, is it of best interest for all concerned? You see, if it's not, if doing something is not best interest for all concerned, that is not a holy arrangement. And the third thing, is it a good testimony? See, even if a proposed marriage is not adulterous, it still may be sin to marry. Now let's give some examples of tangles. Suppose Jack is divorced and has no previous God-joined marriage. Is he free to marry Jill, who is a virgin? Now before you answer, I'll ask you dads. If your daughter's name was Jill, if you had a virgin, would you like her to marry Jack? Most fathers say no, because they realize it's not in their virgin daughter's best interest to marry somebody that was in a tangle like that. I'll guarantee you that these are the kind of processes that work. You know, a young virgin might think, I know he sinned, but he's repented, and I accept that. But I'll guarantee you that after marriage, it will be an issue in her mind. She will wonder if she is as satisfying as that other woman was. But there are other entanglements. There may be financial entanglements if a man is formally divorced. You know, previous marriages involve payment of alimony, and the new marriage will be stressed by this financial burden. That is unfair to the new wife. I believe any marriage should not be initiated into a situation of financial stress. And by the way, if a man is not prepared to support his wife properly, he better wait to get married. Another entanglement is children from previous marriage. A man who has children from previous marriage, regardless of the entanglement, is responsible to nurture and train them. Now it turns out that at first, absent fathers make an attempt to see their children. But as time passes, the interaction decreases dramatically, either because of distance or because of a new wife and children or because of the hostility with the ex-wife. 10 years later, according to sociologists, 2/3 of all those children have no contact with their father. You see, if a man has previous relationships of which he has children, his responsibility is to focus on ministry to them. Third, I believe it's a problem to burden a new wife or a new spouse, whichever way the direction is going, with a triangle relationship. If a man has had a previous marriage, he has a relationship with that other woman, and even though that relationship has been legally dissolved as far as marriage goes, if there are children involved, he has to be interacting with her regarding visitation rights, various kind of things, and now he has this new wife, and so he has to interact with her, and he also has to interact with this other woman. It's a problem. Furthermore, we must remember the importance of good counsel. We must counsel what is good for every member of the body of Christ, not just to try to make life more pleasant for Jack, who made foolish choices. People have this kind of notion. Well, Jack did wrong. He knows he did wrong. And so why can't he have a new beginning and marry this nice girl? You see, society thinks someone else should pay the price for one's own folly. And that notion has slipped into the church. I'll guarantee you Jack will bring bad baggage into that marriage. Would you want your virgin daughter to marry him? Most men say no. Then neither should you want someone else's virgin daughter to marry him. We've got to give what is best counsel for the daughter just as much as for the man. So, what if two people divorced from illegitimate unions? Could they marry each other? And you know what I think? That puts the marriage on an equal footing, because both partners then bring sexual baggage. She may have difficulty giving herself totally because of past hurts. And each know that the other has had memories of bad relationships and past relationships. However, in regard to the discussion earlier, if there are children in either marriage, the triangle relationships would be introduced, and I think that that suggests the marriage should be avoided. Remember, promiscuous life is foolishness. Somebody might say, well, I didn't get married all those times, but I had quite a few flings. You know, a man in immoral relationships sins against his own body. 1 Corinthians 6:18. And whoever marries him gets spoiled goods. There are too many men floating around in our fellowships who deliberately lived immoral lives, and then they think that after repentance they should be able to marry a virgin. It would be more appropriate for them to choose a woman who had also messed up and repented, choosing to minister to her. I know an example of this. There was a man in a certain church in the United States. He lived a promiscuous life, but he truly repented, and he wanted to marry a virgin. And there was a young woman in the church who had been promiscuous and had a daughter. And she also had truly repented. And the leaders thought it would be good for him to consider her. And at first, he didn't like the idea. He wanted a virgin. But as he prayed and thought, he decided to begin her courtship, and they were happily married. You know, we've got to be fair about this and realize that it is not in the best interest of a virgin to marry somebody who's been catting around. And it's interesting, when I've talked about this, there have been occasions where some men in the audience didn't like it. I wonder if they would have liked to share their testimony of where they've been. If someone has had a complex tangle of sexual union with many, legitimate marriage to none, children from various unions, and then he joins the church and separates from his illegitimate adulterous union and married somebody new, it would certainly be a bad testimony. Simply whether a new union would not be adulterous is not sufficient to determine that such action would be righteous. Let's keep that in mind. In other words, the point I'm making is, we can go through the sequence that I presented up there, and we can find out whether the union is adulterous. And if it's not adulterous and it already exists, you don't tamper with it, because God joins those unions that are legitimately married. But if somebody is proposing marriage, even proposing something that is non-adulterous, if it has these other considerations, it still might not be righteous. And that's the part to remember. You see, someone has said this, and I quote, "Although the physical union is not a marriage bond, it is a physical bond. It is also an emotional bond, and it may be a procreative bond. The more tangled these bonds, the more inappropriate marriage would be." I've heard of a church that they do not count invalid marriage as marriage, rightfully so, but they let folks know that have been involved in those situations that they will not marry them. Don't expect to come here to this church and marry a virgin. I think it's important to remember, in dealing with a proposed marriage from a mixed-up background, there's some things to check. Check the death certificate for his legitimate wife to see if his legitimate wife is indeed dead. Check the marriage eligibility for all his wives. Maybe his first wife had been divorced, and the second wife would have been the legitimate one. There's all kinds of things to check and find out what is going on here. Find out also why those previous marriages failed. It's very likely that a man has had a bunch of marriages is part of the problem. And those character flaws will become obvious after you marry. Some of them might be obvious before to a seasoned observer, but they will become obvious afterwards for sure. And consider also whether the losses are greater than the gains. I mean, maybe it would be lawful to marry, but not expedient. Or maybe it would be lawful, but it produces an unrighteous testimony. And also, remember this, it may be that people are so emotionally involved at the moment that it's difficult to make a wise decision. So, how do you resolve existing tangles? I mean, those that are in an invalid marriage, couldn't they continue to live in the same house but just live celibately? You should go back to the Old Testament and review it, Genesis 20, the story of Abimelech and Abraham's wife. God spoke to him at night and said, "Abimelech, you're a dead man because of the woman that's in your house." He didn't say the woman in your bed. He even said, Abimelech said, I didn't know it. She said, he's my brother. And he said, she's my sister. God said, I know that. And I didn't allow you to touch her. But now give her back, or you're finished. You see, it wasn't just let her stay in a separate room. There are two reasons for physically separating if you are in an illegitimate union. One is testimony to the community. If you're living in the same house but celibately, you can't have a sign out there that anybody will believe saying, we live here together, we're celibate. And it will reduce the temptations for immorality. I had a long conversation with a woman down in southern United States. And she specifically cited my two reasons, which I listed a little bit ago, for physical separation: testimony of the community and reduced temptation. She said that when she and her husband first realized that they should not be together, they at first lived in the same house but with different bedrooms. Then he moved out of the house. Then they realized they needed more distance and he moved farther away. She sees how that distance was important. And they cooperate with each other in the raising of their child. And they go to the last time we were there at that church, they were both going to the same church. Contrast is another couple I know of. They saw the error of their marriage. They lived together, but celibately. She rode in the back seat of the car. They cared for the children together. But they resented it when their pastor talked to them about how this was not a good testimony. And they joined another church of another denomination. And a year later, they had a baby. You see, they gave in to temptation and lost out. Now, people might wonder, well, why can't Deuteronomy 24 be used today to prohibit reuniting the first marriage? The theology is clear. Deuteronomy 24 is legislation for the old covenant, which allowed divorce and remarriage. So it's legislating what can be done in certain remarriage cases and divorce cases. But the new covenant is totally separate, which says divorce and remarriage are not allowed. And so you can't go back to a piece of regulation that is dealing with a situation where divorce and remarriage are allowed and pull that in and claim that that gives you the clue for the New Testament situation. You see, the Old Testament was regulating an evil practice. And so it said, if you ever divorce your wife and she remarries, you can never take her back under any circumstances. The New Testament doesn't permit divorce and remarriage, and so the situation is different. And furthermore, prohibiting restoration with your legitimate wife conflicts with Jesus' teaching that marriage is binding for life. The fundamental issue is that first marriage that you had, is it a God-joined marriage, and therefore you are still married to the first wife? And the New Testament clearly answers you're still married to the first wife, even if you get a legal divorce. So if you're still married to the first wife, you have a God-given obligation to minister her, if it possible. And that means to restore the relationship and love and cherish her, like Ephesians 5 talk about, if that is possible. In other words, they have obligations to fulfill to one another. You see what we need to do? We need to avoid the cancer of adultery and the cancer of shunning Christ's body. Either one of those is a serious sin. If a person is involved in tangles, but yet their current marriage is a legitimate marriage and they come wanting to fellowship in your church, and you say, no way, that looks too complicated, go away, you are shunning part of Christ's body. Now, understand this. I understand this is an explosive issue, and people have a legitimate fear of opening floodgates for immorality in the church. But we cannot operate on the basis of fear. We must operate on the basis of what is right. You see, there are people who have taken Paul's teaching on grace and twisted it into a license for licentiousness. That doesn't mean the teaching on grace is not correct. Similar here. God expects us to study the scriptures and use his wisdom and grace in relating to each situation. You see, truth regarding marriage and divorce is perverted by those who refuse to obey God. You know, in the church, many cases, modern philosophy is self-centered. It is not the denial and Christ-centeredness that Christ requires. And one of the problems in many of our churches is that people think it's impossible to be fulfilled without being married. And you know, the Scripture teaches that that is not true. You know, when people believe in Satan's counterfeits, which he proposes as an angel of light, new ways will be devised to justify what clearly violates God's revealed will. And left long enough, those ideas will become entrenched and people will teach them as doctrines. The divorce rate among major denominations in the 1960s was 1 in 4,000. And then in an article written in 1981 in Moody Monthly, it showed that divorce among evangelicals was rapidly approaching that of society. And since that time, the divorce rate among evangelicals is more than society. You see, seeds were planted in the early years, in the 60s, for a harvest when people began allowing for divorce in exceptional cases, divorce and remarriage. What has happened in our nations, here in North America, we have a generation that calls evil good and good evil. And so society rapidly deteriorates. You know, wisdom is crying out in the streets. Our society has destroyed the legal foundation of marriage. It is easier to get a divorce that says no fault, just we don't want to live together anymore, than to break a business contract. If you break a business contract, you're liable. And they can come after you legally for damages. And what has our society done? No fault divorce. One book I read said that 80% of divorces are unilateral. That means 80%, only one person of the couple wanted the divorce. Wisdom is crying in the streets. You know, when we do not heed, think about the message of the Old Testament. When the Israel did not heed the message of the prophets, the verbal message, that is an easy thing to heed. God sent them blight and mildew and lack of rain. That's a little tougher. God sent them Syria. And finally, God sent them Tiglath-Pileser of Assyria. You know, the same thing is true for those who disobey God's standards of marriage. They embrace the consequences upon themselves and upon their children. In fact, one of the things that happens in a society that has lots of marriage fractures, the young people grow up and they feel cautious about marriage as maybe not being worth it because they've seen so many sad experiences. Theology determines morality and morality determines theology. If you have your theology wrong, your study of the Scriptures wrong, it will produce bad moral results. But if you also live in a bad moral way, it will produce wrong theology as you try to justify your bad moral behavior. The only solution is to stand rock solid on what God has said and say that that must determine the course of my life. Jesus and Paul were not intimidated by a corrupt society to avoid making clear statements regarding marriage, and neither should we be. We have to have clarity, something that's emphatic, clear, unflinching, declaring what God has said. But at the same time, we must have compassion. These things involve heart-wrenching tangles. Knowing that preparing people for eternity is the most loving thing we can do. Just imagine standing at the judgment bar of God and being told, you are an adulterer and are going to the lake of fire. That is far more heart-wrenching than 70 years of misery. So in summary, remember there are two questions that you need to ask when you want to understand the subject of marriage, divorce, and remarriage. What makes a marriage and what dissolves a marriage? And when you understand the answers to those two questions, it will produce the correct answers to the rest. A marriage is made when the legitimate Parameters are met. Remember from the lessons in Genesis chapter 1 and 2. And the marriage is broken in terms of dissolved. It's dissolved by death. Death of the body. What we really need is resurrection life. We need resurrection life for the person that's in a marriage tangle. It is not possible in your own strength to deal with all that stuff that's necessary to live a holy life. We need resurrection life for every person who isn't in a marriage tangle so that they can live a life that's exemplary before God and before the world. And resurrection life so that when we deal with people who are in marriage tangles, we do it with compassion and love and integrity and clarity and firmness. All those things together, not missing one. Lord bless you.